Accession number 23365, reel number 1.
Accession number 23365, reel 1.
This is Colonel John McGregor interviewing Mr. Derek Halley on the 16th of November 2000. Now, Derek, will you please tell me where and when you were born?
I was born in Crieff on the 17th of April 1933.
And where did you go to school?
And I went to school first to the local primary school in Crieff and then on to Morrison's Academy, where I won a bursary for Morrison's Academy.
And what were your favourite subjects at school?
Sport was one, and I think English and maths is about all. I wasn't much of a student at all.
And in sport, what did you play?
I played a good bit of rugby and cricket.
Did you continue that as you grew older?
Not a bit. As I grew older, I went into the sort of agricultural line, and we didn't have much time to come home and play sport. That was it.
And what did your father do?
My father was a local grocer's vanman. Went round the countryside, all the shepherds and that. And that was during the war, where it was all zoned, and he enjoyed his work.
Yes. And did you ever go with him when you were a schoolboy?
Oh, often. That was part and parcel to the Saturdays. As we got older, there were five of us, and we each had to take a turn to help Father on the Saturday.
And what made you go into agriculture later on?
It was something I had a great notion for animals and livestock and what have you, and the open air, the type of life.
And did you have in your sort of grandfathers and so forth, did you have anyone who had been a farmer?
Indeed, they were coach hirers at one time, going back, always involved with horses and one thing or another. But I can't really remember the coach hiring days before me.
Now tell me, how did you come into the army and into the Black Watch?
Well, I was a shepherd with a firm, Mill Hills, a steward of Mill Hills, and as our age came up and we're due to go for our medical. National service compulsory in these days when you turned 18, and I automatically went for my medical, but thinking that agricultural workers were exempt at that time from doing any national service, but the boss, Mr. Stewart, he thought this was a good thing for every youngster to do a stint in the forces, so he wouldn't stop us, and automatically we were called up. Our choice during the medical, they asked us if you had any choice, and of course I automatically said our local Highland Regiment, and that being the Black Watch.
I never had any regrets.
I have had no regrets, indeed no. Going back through and listening to it, no. At one stage, it comes up that, you know, we were a wee bit cheesed off with the life we were leading, but at the end, in hindsight, it was absolutely... I should never have left the army. Should never have come out. I'm sorry I ever did, actually.
Yes. Now, will you take your story on from there?
Yes, certainly. It starts on Thursday, the 3rd of January 1952. I presented myself at Queen's Barracks, Perth, to start my 2 years national service. And after about 8 weeks of square bashing, I was sent on to Fort George, there to complete our training. From there, we were drafted down to Southampton and had a 6-week sailing on the Empire Fei and disembarked in Hong Kong, where more skills were learned before a move on to Kyrie in Japan. And it was in Kyrie we were supplied with a complete wardrobe of winter combat clothing and were soon sent to Korea. It was about November the 20th, just 2 days after the Black Watch won their battle honour. The winter was well and truly set in. The cold really was unbearable. It was a shock to our system. Not only wearing all the winter clothing, but having to sleep in dugouts with no beds, sheets or blankets, which we had now been well accustomed to. Sleeping bags into which we slept in full underwear, including our socks. It was absolutely unbelievable. It was 1952 and all wars were supposedly to end. I was 19 years old, halfway around the world, and lying in a hole surrounded with sandbags. The vermin was terrible. Rats run around day and night. They were burrowing in the sandbags. Our homes, they were called hoochies. They were about 8 foot square, with two, sometimes three chaps in each hoochie. We made beds by stealing iron pickets and field telephone wire and stringing them together. Well, enough in the front line, we slept daylight hours and stood in the trenches during darkness, staring into the dark for any movement of the enemy. Listening patrols were sent out every night. The patrol had to find its way down the hill through the wire defences towards the paddy fields, which were frozen during the winter. They moved in silence, sometimes 50 yards, and sat and listened, then moved on again. This went on all night, hoping to engage the enemy and perhaps take a prisoner. It was scary and tiring. But we were issued with a tot of rum after a night patrol, something to look forward to get warmth inside. All night and every night, enemy mortar shells would burst round our trenches, and our own mortars and tanks would reply, so we had bangs and flashes, all sorts of noises throughout the night.
How far was the main enemy line from your line?
In some stages, when we were right up in the front front line, it could be anything from, in some occasions, less than 200 yards, 300 yards. Other defence along the ridge might be somewhere up to 700-800 yards.
And the country around there?
It was very steep. And valleys, and it run down, and you know, there were round ridges of hills, and it landed down into valleys, and there was a river in between us and the enemy most of the time.
And a lot of rocks?
Oh yes, it was rocks, and it was very bare ground, but owing to the amount of mortar and gunfire, the wildlife was non-existent. We retired to our hoochies at daylight, and we made our grub. It was compo rations. Those small tins, and they varied. Beans and sausage, and beans and corned beef, spam, etc. And two slices of bread were issued per day. We had to heat these tins on a homemade fire. Again, we had to improvise. An empty ammo box, half filled with sand, a jerry can of fuel, of paraffin or diesel, fixed above the level of the fire, and a drip feed of fuel into the box of sand. This was our only mode of heating water to wash and shave. It was a novelty at first, but after 6 weeks and 7 days a week, temperature which was rising, going down to minus 40, it made you begin to hate not only the enemy, but being in the army. We had no radios, we had no newspapers, so we hadn't a clue what was going on in the rest of the world. But another scary job I had was inspecting minefields. Every morning before first light, I and one other had to walk round the perimeter of the minefields, checking that the wire hadn't been broken by mortar fire or by the enemy, who may have turned the wires in so as someone might walk into it, and to make sure the danger plates were all still hanging on the fence. This job took about an hour. It was terrifying, but by law it had to be done. After some 6 weeks in the trenches, we were moved back to a reserve position. That was only about 3/4 of a mile back. We were allowed to relax, have a shower, but still we had to dig and dig and dig again, reinforcing trenches, repairing wire defences, etc. I was lucky enough to get 5 days rest and recuperation. Went to Japan for 5 days. Well, mind you, that was the only time I had off in the 11 months. One of the surprises, never forget, we got was on Christmas morning, and we were in reserve. The officers came round with a china mug filled with tea and laced with rum, seemingly a regimental tradition, and was well received. I still have my mug. Perhaps the museum might want it. The regiment was sent back to the Hook in May 1953. Again, we settled in for a month's long haul. The night of the 18th, the Chinese were massed as never before. Deep dugouts in the semicircle. 122mm guns lost a barrage at us. The Chinese infantry kept coming towards us. This time the US 8-inch persuaders were firing over our heads. 60
what were persuaders?
It was a type of a shell that when it hit the ground it burst out the way. And the 60mm mortars, they were firing flares, and there were huge searchlights from the Centurion tanks and lit up the sky. So we could see the enemy advancing. They were like, just like an anthill. Up the hill they came. They were within 20 yards, bugles blaring and burnt guns firing. The shells were screaming, the mortars thundering. It was a blur. We kept firing our weapons, and the enemy falling in front, but more and more came in. Eventually, they came over into our trenches. It was hand to hand. And we were taking a bit of a battering, but we were giving the Chinese much more in return, although they were at least somewhere like 16 to our one. Finally, smoke streams came down and the bugles sounded louder, much louder, and the enemy retreated. They collected their wounded, their dead. The count that morning with us was 2 officers, 1 sergeant, 2 privates were killed, and numerous wounded. It was a bad night, but nothing to the toll the Chinese had.
And you had vision of the withdrawal? Could you see them going?
Oh yes, indeed. Well, the smoke bombs came down, and it was a cloud of smoke, and they were up at the wire and they were picking up their dead, and they took their dead away. Yes, indeed. Then the grapevine, by this time we'd heard something about the Queen's coronation. I believe lots of street parties were held at home. At our colourful party, standing in the trenches and watching the Centurion tanks firing red, white and blue smoke bombs. That was our coronation. But this time our stint in Korea had come to an end with a sad farewell to those in the Pusan Cemetery not to come with us.
Would you, which cemetery?
Pusan.
And in Pusan was?
It was the cemetery of the of all the troops that were killed in British or United Nations cemetery in Pusan.
And date?
Sorry?
And the date?
The date was about 20...
Well, the months will do.
June. 1953. It was a most moving service. 21 gun salute, and we had a walk through the 1,090 crosses of British soldiers who were killed. With tears in their eyes, it was a sad farewell. We sailed from Korea, not for Southampton as we had hoped, but to Mombasa in East Africa to help to quell the uprising of the Mau Mau.
When did you know that you were going to East Africa?
About halfway through the journey, about maybe fortnight, 3 weeks after sailing. We hadn't a clue where we were going.
Did you? Were you told why you were going there? What was the purpose?
As an 18-year-old, or 19, by this time 19-year-old, you just took it all in your perhaps the officers were told why, where and when, but it didn't come back to us, and it was just a case of you stand your head, you stand your head. So it was we just sailed on. So it, from Mombasa we travelled by train to Nairobi, and then it was a long haul on the road by road to a town called Nakuru. We were then into 3-man tents, and they were our only home this time, but still no sheets or blankets.
But what was your impression of the countryside and the temperature?
Well, it was totally different. The countryside was very green and lush, and lots of trees, and of course there was civilization in Nakuru itself. But we were again billeted out with the towns, and there was nothing at all. The heat was wonderful, it really was, but very cold at night. But this time, you see, we were very high. In Korea, we were something where about 200-300 feet above sea level, maybe 500 feet above sea level. But in the Kuru, we're into the thousands of feet above sea level. So we had to get quite a bit of training done for about 3-week period to get acclimatized to the air and the conditions.
Totally different. Right.
Totally different. Uh-huh. And it was a case of going in and patrolling the jungles in search of the terrorists. A far cry from Korea right now. Quite an experience, all this, for a young National Serviceman. I was by this time thinking of my demob. After about 4 months in Kenya, it eventually came. I was so excited about going home, but soon realised my friends I had were regular soldiers and were staying behind. It took me years to get over the wonder of comradeship. Thinking back, I really shouldn't have left the Black Watch. 40 years on, watching TV after the Falklands War, I was listening to all the complaints and trauma from British soldiers there. We were all regular soldiers by choice, who were trained to shoot at the enemy and to be shot at themselves. It was their chosen way of life. So I decided to write a short account of my National Service, 1952 to 1954, In my book, The Iron Claw, tells all my experiences, and I would like to think my book as a little contribution to the regiment's history.
What gave you the thought of the title, The Iron Claw?
I don't know. It just seemed to come as a... I was clawed into the army. It wasn't by choice at the beginning. It was odd. It was different. Just like myself, different.
But listening to your account, despite the extreme hardships of the two different theatres of war, you enjoyed your service.
Indeed, yes. I can't say I never enjoyed it, no matter how difficult, no matter the conditions we were in, the extreme conditions we were in, yes.
Going back to the time that you got aboard the ship at Southampton, how much information did you get as to where the destination was to be?
None whatsoever. The destination was to be either Singapore or Hong Kong. We had no choice on it whatsoever. And you just didn't... I was actually drafting. There was a draft of 30 or so chaps, and I was put in charge of them on the draft on going out to Hong Kong.
As a lance corporal?
As a full corporal.
Full corporal.
They made me up to full corporal for drafting only. And I held the documents on board the ship, but mind you, the ship had 2,000 or 3,000 of other soldiers going all over the place. And it just so happened that we got told nothing except we'd come in and go off, and we were picked up in Kowloon, actually.
Yes. And so you didn't know you were going to the 1st Battalion?
Absolutely not.
A little bit more, please, about the terrain in Korea, because people want to have a mental picture.
Well, for a Perthshire person, or a Highland person, it's not unlike the hills we have round about Crieff, really. There's many a day we've gone up a burn or up in round the area, and you say to yourself, this is just like it. There's just hills, mountainous, but not gigantic mountains, not anything like the Grampians, but
steep.
A bit steep and into valleys. And as I say, all these valleys were farmed as paddy fields. It was a very hot summer in Korea. They had the two extremes, and they grew rice in the paddy fields. So it was not unlike Scotland. I wouldn't say anything other than that.
It was recognisable to your eyes. As
oh, indeed, yes. Yes.
And did the Chinese attempt all the time to get above you on the hills?
I think we didn't realise what was going on, and we were just placed in positions that had been chosen by others, the powers that be. But we did realise after and since then that there was the area in the Hook was a passageway or a right of way or whatever, a roadway at one time between the north and the south, and they came via our area we were in to Seoul. We didn't know this at the time. We weren't told, we weren't notified in any way. And these hills were sitting looking down into these valleys, and the Chinese were that desperate to get in through or hold these positions so they could advance through. And I think this is where the strategy of the whole thing depended. But you had to be on a hill. I mean, it's like anything else. There's no point in sitting at the bottom of a hill and trying to fight up it. It's better being at the top of the hill and fighting down it to see what's coming.
And in the line and in the actions, did you come in contact with the other forces, the Americans or the Australians?
Not as individuals, not as the platoons or platoon leaders at all in any way. We had only contact was between the officers of the platoon, the one officer in the platoon, and the sergeant, and then back up to us corporals. And we were actually running our own show. it wasn't as if you anybody came and told you what to do. It was your place to do it.
Yeah. In other words, the local strategy was very much in the hands of the commanding officer.
Oh yes, indeed. Yes. Indeed.
And now that you know so much more about the equipment, what would you have liked to have had that we have nowadays in that situation? Communications, for example?
Oh, definitely. Communication would have been ideal. That. I don't honestly think there's anything more you could have done, apart from the modern weapons, and I've never handled them at all, but as long as they were dependable enough, yes. We worked with mostly American Browning machine guns out there. They weren't the British machine guns.
You didn't use the LMGs that we...
No, it was static Browning machine guns sat in there.
And were they efficient?
Oh, and yes, they were belt-fed, and that meant you hadn't to stop as often, but yes, they were very efficient.
Yes. So, have you anything else you would like to add to your story as you look back?
Not really. I think overall my time in the Black Watch was super. I met a lot of good friends. I've got one in particular who I knew when I was working as a shepherd. We went through the thing together. He carried on, served with the Black Watch. He then served with another regiment, but he finished up a major. And I have a lot of time for them, as Richard Gillis, and he's now in America, and we keep in touch. His father was the QM in the 1st Battalion, Captain Quartermaster.
Well, thank you very much.
That's it.
That was very, very good.